Of gauge theory, non-abelian gauge theory, using this trick of, well, first, the fact that one has to, in order to take into account gauge fixing in a precise way, we have to take into account this Fadeyev-Popov determinant in the functional integral, and then I'll explain in more detail what I alluded very quickly at the end, that this functional determinant can be represented by adding extra fermionic degrees of freedom. So let me remember what we did. This is one. So we started from a gauge field theory, namely with an AMUA field. So this was for SU2. So A was, there is one generator per generator of the symmetry group, so we can regroup this into AMU, which is AMUA, yes, TA, where TA are the generators of, the Lie algebra of SU2. So the TAs are one half of the Pauli matrices sigma A, from A equal 1 to 3. Okay, from this we define the covariant derivative. Which for fields which belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2 acts on a field like d mu of some field in the adjoint representation. This is the ordinary adjoint representation plus or minus, so minus I, the commutator of this matrix with the field in the adjoint representation. And that's something we are going to explain. The gauge transformation are gauge transformation are AMU into AMU plus D mu of some infinitesimal gauge transformation, where alpha belongs to also alpha belongs to the adjoint representation. From this, we introduce the standard way, the field strength tensor, the analog of the field strength for electromagnetism, which contains E and B, which is I won't need much of it, but this is the ordinary d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, but then there is an I factor, there is a commutator of a mu and of a nu with a plus or minus I, and I always forgot what it is. So that's minus I, and yes, and finally we have the action. The action for this SU2 gauge field of A, which is, if I'm not mistaken, minus, well, 1 over 2 d squared integral over dx in 4 dimensions, let's say, of trace of f mu nu. Okay. I think the minus is when you have are dealing in Minkowskian. That's in Minkowski, and there is a plus in Euclidean case. So the action has to be positive. Okay. Now, we discussed the procedure of gauge fixing, that you have to introduce, as in QED, gauge fixing. For instance, the one I was discussing was the Lorentz gauge. Lorentz-Landau gauge, which was ordinary derivative of AMU, so it's covariant derivative, so it's ordinary derivative of AMU, equal zero, and we are going to change it a bit later on, and therefore, if you want to perform a proper functional integral quantization, starting from something which is gauge invariant, which is an integral over dA exponential of minus, well, let's say I over h bar s for gauge fixing. Well, g phi is gauge field, but it's also gauge fixing, so it's a bit, so let me call it Young-Mills. Why for Young-Mills theory? Young-Mills of A, which is a perfectly well-defined, but it integrates over a lot of redundant gauge degrees of freedom, gauge transformation. You can write this as adding formally a delta function of d mu mu. This means imposing on each point of space-time and for each component of the gauge field a mu a, the constraint that d mu a mu a of x is equal to zero. Okay, but then if we perform that, in order to keep gauge invariance, we have to introduce the Fadeyev-Popov determinant, which is a functional determinant, so it's an determinant of a differential operator, but for the, in this case, this Fadeyev-Popov determinant is just the variation of the gauge fixing condition when you perform a gauge transformation. So that's basically d mu, the ordinary derivative, applied to the covariant derivative. Okay, and in order to make this a positive definite operator, you can have a minus, but that's not important. Okay, so this is the Fadeyev-Popov determinant. And this is the gauge fixing term. Okay, so that's a compact, but I hope unanswerable. Okay, and now I explained briefly at the end of the last lecture that under some, let's say, reasonable assumption, but which can be checked to be valid when one is performing perturbative theory, namely considering gauge field configuration which are close to the vacuum, so a mu equals zero, they are valid. You can show that you can represent this determinant of d mu, d mu, and remember, d mu, capital d mu, the covariant derivative contains the gauge field. So this is an operator which depends on the gauge field. You can represent it by the rules of fermionic path quantization by a path integral over, I think it's C and C bar, is my notation, of exponential, well, this is a differential operator, so it's determinant exponential, and then I have to be a bit careful with the sign. I always say signs. This is I hope I haven't, yes. So my action is well, I'm going to write it like this. Okay, well, oh, it's not very important, but usually I integrate over the C, then over the C bar. So that's exponential integral d4x over spacetime of C bar d mu of C. Well, in fact, it should be with a minus sign. I have a plus sign here, but that's not very important, I think. Anyway, it's up to a constant, so this is a formal notation. But here, you have to be remember that C and C bar are fields which belongs in the fundamental representation. So C means C in the fundamental representation, so it has CA of X. So you have a collection of CAs of X. So C is a 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrix, but with Grassmann numbers as components. So you can write this as CATA. But beware, those are Grassmann's numbers. In the same way, the C bar, it's a conjugate of the C, is, well, if you want to take the trace, it's, well, you are going to have a trace somewhere. But you can denote this as CA of X, T, well, TA. And if you take the trace, because this is a 2x2 matrix, this is a 2x2 matrix, you take the trace like you took the trace for this. Trace. The trace might introduce the one half factor that I didn't vote here. So basically, this means exponential of C bar A, this matrix CA. But you have to remember that D mu is a matrix too, the covariant derivative. So you can integrate by part by writing the d mu here, if you prefer. It's not. So you have integral over d4x of the ordinary derivative. Well, you get a minus sign d4x. That's the notation convention from my book, from my notes. And so you have C bar A of X, I'm sorry, you have D mu, the ordinary derivative of C bar A of X, times the covariant derivative of C of X, but you take the component A of this, the component A of the covariant derivative. Okay? Well, if you want to be doing correctly things in Young Mills, you can add factor I. It's not very important, so you can add a factor plus I if you like. Okay, and so basically, this is an action which involves two derivatives, but with a covariant derivative acting only on the C's. And of course, the C means CA of X. Well, this is C bar CA. So both the C bar field and the fields belongs to the adjoint representation of SU2. So there are three component fields, and this action, this new term, is like a term for a free field, except that the free field, the fields are coupled to the gauge field, A mu. So this term, and if you are interested in writing this in terms of component, you can write this as of exponential. Well, let me go back to the Minkowski case, which is, I think, what I wrote. You can write this as exponential of I can put an H bar if I like, but that's not very important, of some ghost or Fadeev Popov action for the gauge field, E, C bar, but it depends on A through the coupling. So this is the Fadeev Popov action. It's the quadratic form in the Grassmann variable, so it makes sense. And explicitly, this Fadeev Popov action for C, C bar A, or C bar C A, is in terms of component, if you take into account that d mu contains a commutator, if I am not mistaken, this is delta, this is C bar A of x on minus the Laplacian, so that's the ordinary term for the scalar fields times delta AB CBX. Okay, so that's the term like for a scalar field with three components, but only they are coupled by the same thing. But then you have the term of the coupling between the C and A, which is contained in the covariant derivative. And if you work out a bit, you write the commutator in terms of component. It involves the structure constant of the algebra, which are the epsilon ABC, the antisymmetric three tensor. And you get finally epsilon ABC. That's the structure constant. Structure constant of SU2. For a general, more general gauge group, they will be replaced by the FABC. And you get d mu C bar A of X. Well, you should put ABC, you should put an index here if you want to be complete. A mu B of X, C index C of X. So this is the term which comes if the group, the covariant derivative was the covariant derivative, for instance, of the Maxwell field with no commutator. And this is the term which comes from the non-abelian the fact that the group is non-abelian. Okay. So we have these new fields. They are coupled to A. So this is this term depends on A, and it's going to compensate the problem which comes if you just do a naive gauge fixing by enforcing this constraint. Okay. So that's important. And as I said, these are Grassmann fields, so they are fermions. They anti-commute. So they are, so those are the ghosts, and anti-ghosts. Okay. That's a standard denomination, and they are called ghosts because they are fermions, because they are anti-commutes. But they do not carry any Lorentz index. They transform in a trivial way under Lorentz transformation. So they are spin zero fields. So they don't satisfy the hypothesis of the famous CPT theorem. which states that for a theory to be unitary, a local quantum field theory, it has to satisfy this CPT theorem. You see, C here is those fields do not carry electric charge, they carry gauge field charge. So there is a problem. So this implies that unitarity is not satisfied. And we are going to see immediately why this is in fact a bonus and not a malus for the theory. Okay, so we have a gauge theory with the ordinary term coming from the standard Young-Mills action, and we have these new gauge fields which are coupled to the electromagnetic field, a bit like the electron, the Dirac field in QED is coupled to the electromagnetism, but there is a d mu here. Okay. So let's see what it means in terms of the Feynman diagrammatic rules of the theory. So in order to do that, there is a trick which is due to Feynman. Or maybe some other people, which is a slight modification of the Lorentz-Landau gauge, which leads to something called the psi gauge. Okay? Which makes calculation simpler. So let's explain what it is. We have seen that this gauge fixing condition leads to this Fadeev-Popov determinant. The trick of Feynman is to rewrite, to replace the delta of d mu a mu equals zero by d mu a mu minus some, some epsilon function equals zero. So I introduce the field, which is a classical field. And if you do this, the Fadeev-Popov determinant doesn't change. You see, you still have determinant of d mu capital d mu as a Fadeev-Popov determinant. So I can replace this term in the functional integral by this term, and the final result is independent of epsilon. So you may choose different epsilon and make an integration over them. Basically, what you can do is you can integrate with an exponential of minus I over 2 times this psi. Psi is just a number. Psi is just a parameter. Okay, and you integrate over 1 I over 2. Yes, no, that's it, psi. And you make a Gaussian integration of this parameter epsilon. So it's still, and you normalized. Okay, so you normalized, you integrate over epsilon. You integrate over epsilon. And this is a Gaussian integration, so it gives you a 2 I pi factor that you have to divide. So basically, if you want to be clear, you have to normalize by 1 over 2 I pi xi or something like that. Okay, but that's just a constant. It gives the same functional integral. So epsilon is an arbitrary gauge fixing parameter. So remember, but epsilon means in fact some epsilon of ATA. So you have, it has also to belong to the fundamental adjoint representation. So in fact, you have 3 epsilon A and integrate over the 3 of them. Okay. But if you do this Gaussian integration, integration, which doesn't change anything on the results because of gauge integration, you can perform it. You know that epsilon is equal to d mu a mu. So when you integrate over the epsilon, you just pick the epsilon, which is equal to d mu a mu for given gauge configuration. So your gauge, in this case, your gauge your action well, your functional integrals become simply integral d of a exponential I the action for the young midfields, okay, plus the action for the Fadeev Popov fields. Fadeev Popov fields, which stays the same, which a function on C bar C and A, or C. And then an additional term, which is just, if I'm not mistaken, S psi of A with S psi of A is just up to some I factor. It's basically 1 over 2 psi integral over d4x d mu a mu a squared. Because you have replaced the epsilon squared by a d mu ordinary derivative a mu squared. Okay, so this is the total action for quantizing a young an SU2 gauge field in this gauge. For a different gauge, it would be something different, but for a different gauge, both the Fadeev Popov term and the A term would be different. But in fact, you know already that the result should be independent of the value of this psi parameter. Okay. So now, with this action, one can perform perturbation theory. There is a G squared term. So one can perform perturbation theory by the standard trick that I explained yesterday. In the functional integrals, you replace A by G, A tilde, so that G is a coupling constant of the gauge field. So G is a coupling constant. It corresponds to the charge of the gauge field, the unit of charge for the gauge field. Because when doing this, the Young-Mills action contains terms of order quadratic in A. So S Young-Mills contains term, roughly speaking, of the form dA dA, but it's 1 over g squared, and this is g squared, so it contains terms of order a tilde mu a, some operator, differential operator k mu nu, which is a differential operator, but then it's d nu a. Okay? And then you have term of order which involves three a's. Well, they involve and one derivative. Well, I'd better write this as a term which involves derivative of a tilde times derivative of a tilde. That's the simplest term, which are the same that in quantum electrodynamics. plus term, which involves 3a but one derivative, because they come from one covariant derivative, and then plus some g squared, some term which involves 3a. And there is a bunch of Lorentz and group indices that I'm going to detail a bit later. So this is for Young Mills. For the Fadiyev Popov action, it contains a term, the ordering term of order dc bar dc, and then you have the term of order which involves some dc bar a and c. So this becomes a term of order g, dc bar a c. Okay, and finally, here, well, you change the normalization of xi so that xi is 1 over is g squared xi tilde, if you like. It's just a parameter, so I'm free to change it. And s for the xi file becomes just 1 half, there is no g, basically d mu a mu squared integrated over a. So you see the at leading order in g, if you consider g as a small parameter, g small parameter, the leading order terms are those three. Which describes free field. So if g at first at zero order, a, c, and c bar are free field. Okay. So for the Young-Mills fields, this is the ordinary term for Maxwell electrodynamics, which, if you don't perform a gauge fixing, cannot be inverted, plus this gauge fixing term, which makes that the quadratic form in A, in both cases, can be inverted. So you can define a propagator. Okay. So at zero order, so let's go first at zero order. If you compute at zero order a mu a and u b, at zero order, so make a calculation for a free theory, it's exactly the same calculation that has been done in QFT1 by Wing Gang for QED, except that you have three gauge fields instead of one. Okay, but basically what you get is that this is, you get basically define this as a green function, the two-point green function delta ib u nu, and in momentum space, if you take the Fourier transform of it in momentum space, this is just the propagator of the photon. So in momentum space, it's g mu a nu. It's just g mu a b of p. Well, you have a global delta a b because the gauge fields are not coupled at that time. So only a mu is coupled to a mu. So it's just charge conservation. And you get Minkowski space, you get k squared minus I epsilon divided by E times the metric of space-time, H mu nu plus psi minus 1 k nu over k squared. Well, that's a P, that's a K. So K is the four momentum. H mu nu is a metric tensor of space-time. And I think in my with my notation, that's plus that's minus plus plus plus, which explains that there is a minus I here. And you see that the psi factor appears there. Okay. And if you had no psi, then you would be in trouble. But okay, so that's in fact the standard photon propagator. Okay. And of course, we can represent it by Feynman rules, like just ordinary wavy lanes. Simply, it carries some indices A and B and carries some momentum K. Okay. So the propagator is the same than the propagator for a photon in the corresponding gauge. Okay. So now for the ghosts. For the ghosts, the only propagator which makes sense, and remember that's the calculation we did, is the ghost propagator CA, and in my notation I put the CA to the left and the C bar A to the Y, zero. So this is a ghost propagator. But the leading term in the ghost action is just an ordinary minus Laplacian, as for the scalar field. Simply, it is dressed by the indices. So this is in momentum space. Something that I'm going to call ghost propagator, that I'm going to call CAB of K, which is, again, there is a delta AB times minus I over K squared minus I epsilon plus, which is the standard Feynman propagator for the scalar field. This is the propagator for the photon, and this is propagator for scalar field. Okay, but you see, you know, there is a C and C bar. So this is going to be represented by a line, oriented line. It's like for the Dirac field. But the only difference is that with a Dirac propagator, that it is just a 2x2 matrix, but with the identity matrix, there are no gamma matrices because there is spin zero. Okay, there is an orientation. And that's it. Oh, and I'm going to, in fact, this is a ghost, so this is not a real particle. So this is a dashed line, which makes things a bit more complicated. So the gauge field will be represented by wavy lines, and the ghost will be represented by dashed line because there are ghosts. Okay, and that's it. So at zero order, you have a free propagating gauge field and free propagating ghost fields. Okay. So now, what about interactions? Well, I think I already described very briefly the interactions that arise from the gauge field action. You had three gauge field interactions, which you can represent by vertex like that. It's a three-particle vertex. Each gauge field, it corresponds to representing the term with an A mu, nu, A mu, no, A mu, A nu, B, A rho, C. So if a gauge field here carries a momentum, a group in this A and a Lorentz index E, if this one carries B, a gauge index B, and a Lorentz index nu, and this one carries a gauge index C and Lorentz index rho, and momentum K, P, and Q, you walk a bit and you recover. You recover a weight for this action, which is for this vertex, which contains a factor G, because it's over the G. Well, the group theory, basically, you have three indices. So basically, the only things you can get from that is a structure constant of the group. But that's what you do if you do. So you get an epsilon A, B, C. And then you get a Lorentz factor, which represents the interaction between how the spins of the particle interacts. There are spin-spin interactions. And basically, this is, of course, you have three indices. So you can construct only things involving the metric tensor and the momentum of the particle, because there is a derivative, which you can submit. But you have only one. So you can have only combination of H mu nu and P for the three indices. And it turns out that what you get is H mu nu K minus P rho. So I combine K and P with the index of the third leg. This makes, and if you take all the symmetric you have three combinations of that, you get a symmetric factor. You get H mu nu K minus P. Well, let me write them explicitly. Plus H nu rho P minus Q mu plus H rho mu, H mu rho Q minus K nu. And if you, for instance, take the K factor and use anti-symmetry, you can regroup them in a different way. Anyway, so you see that the interaction involves momenta. They involve momenta. If you regroup the factor K, you can write this as K rho H mu nu minus K nu H rho mu plus the three terms. And these terms would correspond to having a term where the interaction depends on the momentum of this leg. And the three of them. Okay. So basically, you have in fact interactions which involve momenta coming along one leg. These terms, for instance, represent this term with the G epsilon ABC. Okay. Now you have interactions for the four, which do not involve the momenta, and which can be represented as some four vertex interactions that are of order J squared, and they depend now of you have A mu, B nu, C rho, and D sigma. You have four Lorentz indices and four group indices. You have no momenta, and basically you get some terms which involve the indices that are written in the notes. You can find them in all the textbook. You have the epsilon ABC, so in fact they should depend on some ad hoc combination of two epsilon ABC, and for instance, the first term is epsilon ABE, epsilon CD from E, you sum over E, and then we have H mu rho H mu sigma minus H mu sigma H mu rho. And to make the thing symmetric, you have three other terms by making permutation. Well, you have two other terms. So you get a product, you know, a product with a summing over this index of the structure constant. But for SU2, this is, in fact, just delta AB. Delta CD minus delta AD delta BC. Where delta is just the Kronecker index. So you see, so this term represents the term where the charge E of A is conserved into this one or goes to D. And then you can, the other terms will give you also terms where the charge is conserved there. Those terms are terms of charge conservation. Well, this term, for instance, means that if you have a charge 1 here and a charge 2 here, then it's charge 3 which gets out. Okay. And, well, that's... let me just write then the Gauss interaction term. The Gauss interaction terms is an interaction between the Gauss field and the gauge field. So it conserves its charge. If you consider that you have a Gauss with a group number C, charge C here, and A gets out, and here I have a B mu gauge field. Then there is some interaction between the group indices. Let me say that this carries a momentum P. This momentum carries some momentum K. And therefore, this carry momentum P minus K. The term interaction is there is a minus G, when there is a minus for some reason, and there is just a P mu. Where mu is a Lorentz index of the gauge boson, but P is the momentum of the ghost. Okay, so it's a bit like Dirac theory, and then you have an epsilon ABC, as you expect from group symmetries. Okay, so you see that the interaction between the gauge field and the Gauss fields mixes the group indices. You have here 1, 2, 3 gets out. Okay, and you have a derivative because you have a D mu C bar. Okay. So those are the Feynman rules. So let's make a short break. And I'll see you, you know, what diagrams comes out in the theory. And then I'll discuss an important aspects of this gauge fixing procedure. and why all this is important. Okay, so let's make a short break. So now let's consider what are the one loop. I give you contribution. So the, let's call the what are the radiative corrections? So we'll discuss that more when doing renormalization. But basically, let's consider, for instance, the radiative corrections to the gauge field propagator. So somehow, what is the vacuum polarization induced by the interaction? Well, in Maxwell's theory, you have only one diagram which is induced by the fact that you can create a pair of virtual fermions. Here I'm considering a pure gauge theory. So there is no such a graph. So if the theory was abelian, Maxwell, there would be no radiative correction. It's just free waves propagating. But here you have diagrams like that. And you have diagram like that. Which induce some vacuum polarization or radiative corrections to the propagator of the photons. So I don't write the symmetry factor, I don't write the group contribution because of, you have a lot of new and group indices that flows. So this is very thematic, but you can compute them just using Vick theorem. Okay, so this is a contribution for the internal gauge field, and you integrate over some momenta. But then you have also the coupling between the gauge field and the ghost. So you have another diagram, which is a diagram where you have a creation and annihilation of a pair of ghosts anti-ghosts. So you have this diagram, which has its symmetry factor, etc. Okay, and that's it, I think. I've not forgotten anything. Now, the important point is that the ghosts are fermions, like the Dirac fields. So to each loop, if you apply Vick theorem, apply the Vick theorem for when you contract fermionic field, you get minus signs. And here you get a minus sign. Very important. Okay. And now what? This is not going to. I have. Oh, I realize that it's another sheet. I don't have the other, but. Well, let's propagate the propagator for the ghost field. This is this. Plus g squared, and you can have, no, that's it. You can't have, can you have a, oh yes, of course. You can have this diagram where you have a virtual gauge field which is created and annihilated. And I think that's it. That's the only one loop diagram. So this is a diagram which is similar to QED, where the propagator of the electron gets a correction by the photon, the gauge field, and that's it. Okay? And then you get other fields that you can write, for instance, the but I don't think I will discuss them, but you have also a radiative correction to the vertex interaction, to this vertex, and to this vertex, which can be, you know, comes from both virtual propagation, creation of intermediate states involving both gauge field and bosons. Okay. But let me stop there here at the moment, because I'll see why loops are very important. You see, when you are considering in Dirac, in QED, when you are considering, you have this additional diagram, which comes out in the propagation of the, well, this is Dirac loop, okay? And these Dirac loops might contribute to the fact that the photon might get a mass. It is dangerous. It could give the factor in the propagator of the photon of the forms delta mu nu times some big mass squared instead of the standard p mu nu minus h mu nu p squared term which come from this propagator. So it could give a mass to the photon. And thanks to gauge invariance, that's something that I'm sure you have seen in QFT1, this term is not here for QED. You know, the vacuum polarization in QED doesn't induce a mass for the photons, thanks to gauge invariance and the Ward identities, etc. Now, in Young-Mills, the first people to study the gauge theories ran into a problem because they had some Feynman rules, they made some calculation, but somewhere, and these two diagrams, this one and this one, in general, generically, would give a mass to the gauge field. And therefore would destroy gauge invariance. But, so they give a mass square term. But in fact, it turns out, that's one of the first of the many miracles, that the loop of fermions gives the same mass term. And because of the minus signs, they cancel. Minus signs make the cancel. So gauge invariance is safe, at least for this process, if you take into account the fact that you have the Gauss. And well, proving that this is true first at first order, so proving that quantum electrodynamics, that Young-Mills fields are still gauge invariance at one loop, and then at any order of perturbation theory, required a lot of work. This was one of the great achievements of quantum VCO in the 70s, and it started with a famous paper by Toft and Veltman, which got the Nobel Prize for this and other things. Veltman, I think there's only one, and which prove that this can be achieved, and that in fact at one loop, the L theories were renormalizable. It has deeply, we'll discuss that later on, but this is the gauge invariance problem is deeply connected to the fact that the gauge theories are renormalizable. Okay, so now I have a bit of still left, so I'm going to do something more abstract, but which is very important, because you'll meet him in different in other fields, which is that the fact that the gauge invariance is still valid at higher order and the fact that the gauge theories are renormalizable, in fact, can be viewed as coming from an important property of gauge theories when you introduce gauge fixing, which is the BRST symmetry. So B calls for Becky, R from Rouet, S for Stora, which were some Italian French group, and T for Tweetlin, or I don't know exactly how to say, was a Russian physicist who made similar things at the same time. So the BRST symmetry is an important symmetry. So it's a symmetry of the gauge fixed theory. Which ensure that when you gauge fix and quantize the theory, you can respect gauge symmetry. Also, if you gauge fix the theory, it has no gauge invariance anymore. So what remains of gauge invariance when you gauge fixed? And that's an important concept discovery, which simplifies a lot of proof, but which is also important in other area of theoretical physics that you'll meet later on in the advanced course. It plays an important role in string theory. It plays an important role in conformal field theory. Okay. So I try to explain very, you know, briefly what is this BRST symmetry. Okay, so first, let's consider the gauge fix theory in the Landau gauge. But so I go back to this action. But I don't use the trick of Feynman to use the psi gauge. This can be done, but it's better seen. So if you just fix the constraints that d mu nu here, so that you have a delta function of d mu a mu, you can represent a delta function as the integral of its Fourier transform, so by what's called a Lagrange multiplier. So you can represent the constraints that delta of d mu a mu is zero by writing it as something like integral over some field b of exponential I b d mu a mu. That's a very compact notation because you know that just that the Fourier transform of the exponential is a Dirac delta function. So and you integrate from minus I to plus infinity with the I factor. So this is something that's well known. You just apply this. And of course, you have to write that for all component of d mu a mu. So in fact, this B is an auxiliary field. That's called an auxiliary field in theoretical physics. When you have some constraint here, this is fixed to zero. You can represent this constraint by an integration over an auxiliary field. It's just Fourier transform a Dirac delta function. And B is, of course, a field with constraint component for each, because d mu a mu a is a 2x2 matrix. Okay, so it's an auxiliary field B a x. So you can represent B as B a a. Sorry, BATA is the trace, and it belongs to the adjoint representation. Okay? So it belongs to the adjoint representation. It has no spin, and in fact, it has no auxilia. I'm writing too much. It has no dynamics. It's just there in the functional integral to implement this constraint. So it has no dynamics. But it's there to make the job of enforcing the constraint. And if you do that, you end up with an action, which writes now. The action price now. So the action for the Young Mills is not changed. For A is not changed. The action for the gauge fixing is not changed. But the action for the ghosts. But the action for the gauge fixing is just this term. So the action for the gauge fixing term, instead of being the psi action that I wrote upstairs here, is just integral d4x, well, if you want, trace of I b times d mu a mu. So you have an action now which involves, you have an action S, which is S Young Mills plus S ghosts plus S gauge fixing, which is an action which depends on now three different kinds of fields. You have A mu, A, the gauge field, physical field. You have the C's and C bar, the ghosts, which comes there for taking into account the gauge fixing condition. And you have the auxiliary field B. I've wrote in a very compact form these fields which depends on, exists on each point of space-time and which has a group indices because it belongs to the adjoint representation. Okay, so you have now an action, a total action. And this action depends on the gauge fixing you have chosen. It depends on the gauge fixing condition. Okay, and remember, A are B are boson. They are real fields with real components. So they, and C bar are Grassmann, so they are fermions. They obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics. Okay. So now, we don't have any gauge fixing, you know, gauge invariance. Yes?
You're saying that P is the auxiliary field and has no dynamics.
Pardon?
Are you saying that P is the auxiliary field and has no dynamics? Yes.
Yeah, it has no dynamics because, you know, it appears only in the action as a linear term. It has no term which depends on its derivative. Okay, that's what I mean.
Using any perturbation?
Pardon?
Aren't we using any perturbation here?
I think you can perform a perturbation theory involving the beach, but it's going to be equivalent to this one somehow. Okay? And if you go to the... if you go to the Feynman Xi gauge, this amounts just to replace, to add a B squared term to that. You can, for instance, I think that's B Xi B squared. B squared. If you go to the, that's not Xi, that's, yes, that's right. Okay, for instance, with a factor one half. Okay, so that's, so you see that the action depends on the gauge fixing condition. If I consider the Xi gauge, the action is slightly different. Okay. So, now, you have no gauge invariance anymore in the theory. If I change A into A plus d mu alpha, A mu into A mu plus d mu alpha, it's not a symmetry. Okay. But there is this BRST symmetry, which is something which seems a bit strange. The idea is replace alpha, the gauge, the parameter of the gauge transformation, which is a classical, you know, which belongs to the adjoint representation, replace alpha by some abstract by, in fact, some epsilon c of x. So instead of making a variation with an arbitrary object, you make c of x is a ghost field. So epsilon, anti-ghost number, but not depending on x. So we are just going to do some algebra. So if this is a, no, this is a ghost, this is some anti-ghost just number, this is going to be a boson. Okay. So replace your gauge transformation by making those transformations. So instead of changing, I change a mu into a mu plus epsilon d mu of c. So I make a transformation which mixes the bosonic fields and the fermionic fields. Okay. So this kind of transformation is called the supersymmetric transformation, because it's a transformation between bosons and fermions in terms of statistics. Okay, so now here comes the beauty. Well, maybe I don't need the diagrams, but I need the algebra, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, maybe, yeah, okay. Now, if you do this kind of transformation of A mu, the action, the total action is still not symmetric. But these gentlemen found out, I don't remember exactly how, that if you make, if you change, again, you make a variation of A mu, where you change A mu into A mu plus this abstract anti-commuting parameters times d mu of c. And at the same time, you make a variation of c by changing c into c plus epsilon. You need some I over 2. And I'm going to consider the products of the c times c. That's a bit strange, because you think that c is a boson, is a fermion, it's a Grassmann variable, so its product is zero. That's true for each component. But this, in fact, what it means is that c times c, if you consider the component A of c times c, which are 2 by 2, matrices, and you use an anti-commutation relation, you find that this is just FABC, so in our case, epsilon ABC, of CB times CC. And these are different fields. And here are the structure constant of the theory. So this is non-zero. Okay, and again, this is a ghost. These are 2 ghosts, these are an anti-ghost. So it has basically the quantum number of ghosts. That's fine. Now, what is the transformation you have to take for C bar? And here you have to distinguish C bar. You take minus C bar minus I epsilon B. B is the auxiliary field, it's a boson. Epsilon is an anti-ghost parameter, so this is same number, okay? And finally, you change B into B. Okay? So this seems a bit abstract, but that's, you know, this is just a gauge transformation with an anti-commuting generator. This is a transformation which involves the structure, the group structure of the theory. This is just a translation by B, and this is zero. So those are, this is a form of an infinitesimal BRST transformation. So you change A into A prime, C into C prime, etc. Okay. So, well, there are details in my notes and in all book, good textbook, but now compute the variation of the action. How does the action changes under such a transformation? So the action, let's first go to the Young-Mills part. And look at what are the term of order epsilon. So you expand, you keep the term of epsilon, but don't forget that the epsilon, the C is anti-commute. Epsilon is a boson. So for instance, if you have an epsilon C, if you somewhere get an epsilon d mu c, this is minus d mu c times epsilon. So taking into account the anti-commutation rules for the fermions, you get that at order epsilon, this is zero. Basically, that's because this is a gauge transformation, and we know that the action, Young-Mills action, is gauge invariant under ordinary gauge transformation, so it's the same algebra. Right? So, in some sense, gauge invariance implies invariance under this BRST transformation. Okay, now consider the gauge field. Consider the gauge fixing term, namely S ghosts plus S gauge fixing. So let's call this H, the S total gauge fixing, okay, which is a functional of A, C, C bar, and B. Well, this S of total gauge fixing, okay, of those fields gets plus some epsilon parameter, and again this parameter is zero, and that's non-trivial. It comes out from this definition. So both the original action and the gauge fixing term are BRST invariant. So S Young-Mills is BRST invariant. That's something which is the same calculation that computing the gauge fixing. But the gauge fixing term also BRST invariant. Okay? And moreover, the BRST transformation doesn't depend on the form of the gauge fixing term we have chosen. So it's a symmetry which is valid for any gauge fixing term we can choose. Okay. And in fact, this a bit strange supersymmetry, which is made by promoting ordinary gauge transformation to transformation involving C and epsilon, is in fact BRST is Z is this symmetry of any gauge fixed theory. Well, for this symmetry, from SU2, any gauge fixing for any gauge fixing choice. We get different Feynman rules for the ghost, etc. It might be more complicated, but anyway, for instance, if you choose different psi, you get different propagator. That's all, but you still get a different propagator. But this symmetry is basically gauge invariance plus gauge fixing becomes BRST symmetry. So it's very abstract, but basically all the observables you are computing are you must look how they transform. And I think I speak a bit more, I have time on Friday, but let me, something which is very important, and you have to check. Let's see what happens when you apply two times a BRST symmetry. So basically, you can define some kind of generator of the BRST symmetry. Generator, this is a charge, or BRST charge operator, Q, so that basically when you apply Q to A, this becomes epsilon D of C. When you apply Q to C, this becomes, no, I'm sorry, you get rid of the epsilon. So the transformation, BRST transformation is epsilon times Q, basically. So BRST transformation amounts to epsilon times Q, Q sub operator acting on your field. So Q of C is I over 2 C times C. Q of C bar is minus I B. Q of B is 0. And look what's happened when you apply 2 times Q. You apply Q to the transform. So what happens if you times Q times Q? Well, you can check. You apply Q once to A, you get D mu C. You apply 2 times Q, you apply Q to C, but you also apply Q to the A in the D mu, which give you some other C. You get also a term involving C, C's and derivatives. Miracle, this is 0. And this is 0 for all fields. So if you apply Q to 2 times to anything, Q times Q, which is Q squared, is 0, which simplifies enormously the calculation. And that's important. So Q squared is a nilpotent symmetry. And so if you think about that, you can see that you can understand very easily why the total gauge fixing term is BRST invariance. The total gauge fixing term, which I've written here, is C bar D G C plus I or minus I B D A integral over X this is a this total gauge fixing term. You can write it as Q applies to integral d4x of C bar d mu a mu, and that's it, I think, in the case of in the case of you see, well, do the calculation. If you apply Q to the A mu, well, you have to, it has to quanti commute, you get a D mu C, you get a D mu C, which is part of this one. But apply Q to C bar, you get B, so you get the B term. The B term dA comes from applying Q to C bar. You see? And I think that's it, okay? And therefore, this is the S total gauge fixing. So if S total gauge fixing can be written as Q times C bar, integral of a C bar times the original gauge fixing term, F of A, where for my case F of A is D mu A mu, and that's a general formula. Q of S total gauge fixing term is Q times Q of integral of C bar F of A, and therefore it's automatically zero. You don't have to redo the calculation for different gauge fixing. You see? Okay, so I'll end up here, and next time I'll show you why this is just a fancy mathematical symmetry devised by some crazy theoreticians, but why it's very important, and in particular how it shows how you get rid of the non-physical states in a gauge theory. So BRST implies decoupling of dangerous states of the gauge field, like, for instance, the longitudinal polarization states which you have discussed in QFT1. I'm going to show briefly why BRST is a right object, is one right object to understand, to see why this decoupling occurs. Okay, so, but this is going to be on Friday. Okay.